You're listening to Japan Baseball Weekly. News, interviews, analysis, and hot takes about all 12 NPB teams. Hosted by Jim Allen and John E. Gibson.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of May 23rd. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a Sunday night at a very decent hour is Jim Allen. How you doing, buddy?
I'm decent.
You've used that one before. You better You have to get a new line. Our listeners need more from you.
I'm fine, thanks. How you doing, man? I apologize. I've used that one before too, but you know, sue me.
get your money back.
Yeah, you're an American. It's your God-given right. Okay.
I'm doing okay. Like I said, recently this weather is getting me down, but I was able to get a run in. I'm down to running maybe as infrequently as twice a week outside with all the injuries and all that stuff. But I had a pretty nice run today, so everything started out nice. And I've been busy since the moment I woke up this morning. So it'd be fun to lay my head onto the pillow tonight.
Okay.
Or this morning. All right. Well, on this week's show, we're going to lay John Shambi on you, the Cubs broadcaster. We're going to talk about the start of interleague play. We've got our Rockin' with Roki segment and a little bit more. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right, so we usually let the Japanese players go when they graduate and move on to the major leagues. But, you know, NHK kind of force feeds us the Cub games this year. And in these COVID times, we just have to evolve. We have to do something different. So I talked to Cubs broadcaster John Boog Shambi, whom I'm quite sure is busier than either one of us, Jim.
Probably.
But he graciously made some time to talk with us, and it was awesome. And I've been listening to USA broadcasters talk about, or Major League broadcasters, but not only Major League, some TV broadcasters as well, talk about MPB players since Hideo Nomo made the jump over to the big leagues in the 90s, in the mid-90s. So there's always a lot lost in translation, let's put it that way. And thanks to news resources recently and the proliferation of English blogs and a lot of networks, and we've got the podcast world out there, things are much better, but by no means flawless. And, you know, nothing can be as perfect as Noki Sasaki, right? So it's always good to gain perspective on what goes into the coverage when these teams pick up an NPB star. And Boog Shambi is someone who has been around this game for more than 20 years. He's calling Seiya Suzuki's rookie season in the bigs, and I reached out to try to find him, and I did. And like I said, he was busy as all get out, I'm sure, but he did make some time for us. It was actually a week ago today. We're recording on Sunday night here on the 22nd. So he made some time for us, and it was real awesome just to sit down and talk a little bit about Seiya Suzuki and just get an idea of how these broadcasters go about covering the Japanese players with whom most they cannot communicate. So let's take a listen to what Boog has to say. All right, joining us on the show this week is John Boog Shambi of the Chicago Cubs broadcasting booth. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's my pleasure. Happy to do it.
All right, so let's hit it up. Let's go right away. When you first were in the facility in spring or getting ready for the season, what were the expectations that you heard inside the club about Seiya Suzuki and what, you know, they were hoping to get out of him as far as this year and then a career?
Yeah, I think that it's you know, it's sort of a multi-pronged answer. I was excited because in looking at what he had done in Japan, he'd been an elite level player, especially an elite level hitter. And I think that the biggest thing that I focused on was that you were getting a player effectively entering peak at 27 years old. You know, this year, I don't think the expectations were for the Cubs to make the playoffs. And I think now we probably have a better idea in the majors of just how hard the transition is for foreign-born players. And I think that if you're talking about a guy who's 27, I think the hope is that he will be at his best when the Cubs are ready to win, when he's 28, 29. But I think that there was a level of excitement, and I would say it was greeted as a really good signing.
And certainly the consistency is the biggest test for any player who's coming up and joining a new league or making a jump in any fashion. But, you know, I've heard talk about the Cubs possibly wanting to build around Suzuki in the future. How real is that chatter?
It's hard for me to say. I mean, if you're asking me my opinion, I think he's a really good player. It depends on what you mean by build around him. I think that he's going to be a crucial piece to the next great Cubs team. I'm not sure if he can be your best player, but he's really good. I mean, that's not a knock on him. I am super excited about how good he has been and how good he will be. But I think he's going to be a crucial piece to the next really good Cubs team. And I'm excited to see, you know, what peak Seiya Suzuki is.
All right. Now, how do you go about covering him? Because I know the interpreter has to be available and you have to make arrangements to do interviews. How do you do that?
Well, so look, the one thing I have to tell you is it has been an absolute joy to cover this guy. Number one, in talking to the guys on the rest of the team, they have loved getting to know him. He has a magnificent interpreter named Toi Matsushita, who is with him everywhere. And there really isn't a huge for formal interviews, yes, but my job as a broadcaster, you know, part of it is I want to humanize him. I want to try to explain to people what's he like. And he is super playful and fun and funny and open and warm. And I couldn't say enough good things about how much I've enjoyed just these little 2-3 minute conversations where I'll just ask Toy something, not a hardcore baseball question about an at bat or what he's doing mechanically, just like, hey, you wore your socks, you know, up last night, pants bloused at the knees, and today you're wearing them down. How do you decide? Just stuff like that, where right. You're just trying to get a feel for what the guy is like. And then you hear the things that you start to get an idea of what he is like. You know, he was a week into his Cubs tenure and David Ross is walking through the weight room holding some trail mix, and Seiya pointed at the trail mix and said, chocolate. And David said, no, it's trail mix. And then he pointed, cause there were M&Ms in the trail mix, and he said, chocolate.
Yeah.
And Rossi said, yeah, actually there's chocolate in there. And then Seiya rubs his belly and says, chocolate. And Rossi says to him, you're too comfortable already, you know, joking. And then, you know, the other one was he was really interested and concerned about what the weather would be like. And the Cubs went to great lengths to show him that the weather he'd be experiencing playing in would not be markedly different than what he had been used to. Well, right. Our weather has been, I mean, just disastrous so far. So cold, so terrible. And we were at home for a game against the Rays where, you know, first pitch, it was probably 41 degrees Fahrenheit, 34 was what it felt like. And he was sort of lingering outside of David Ross's office. And Rossi said, what are you guys waiting for? And he and Toy walk up to the doorway and say a taps Toy. And Toy says to David Ross, the manager, he just wants you to know that those charts that you gave him were bullshit.
Right. And you told that story on the ESPN broadcast. And I wonder, how do you go about gathering and collecting and mining for stories about him?
You do it every way you possibly can. You know, one of the first things I did was I connected to some people and I got in touch with Kevin Crone, who played with Seiya on right. Hiroshima last year. So I texted with Kevin, just what's he like? Going back and forth in that regard. I'm sure you know Brad Lefton, you know, is yep. a guy I've known for a long time. So I asked him about him. And then any time I can just get be there for moments. We were at Atlanta. Chip Carey, who's the Braves play-by-play guy, came over and they had just gotten their rings. And I stood there as he showed Seiya his World Series ring and to watch Seiya experience it and his facial expressions and all of that. And you're just trying to build this connection with a guy to get to know him. And there's the barrier of the language. So I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, look, it's challenging for sure, but I just, there's a willingness and an openness that is so clearly on display with him. There is such a, it just really feels like he wants to be here to succeed. There's nothing closed off about him. And I find it so appealing and he's so easy to root for. And he's super skilled. You know, like when you go baseball, the baseball nerd in me, he doesn't chase. That's a huge thing. Like, I think if I were to look at the numbers that I like the best with him, it's that he hit 91 homers his last 3 years in Japan and walked more than he struck out. In the United States right now, strikeouts, it's hitting is harder than it's ever been. It's just really hard. So having an idea of the strike zone is crucial, and he has an idea of the strike zone. So I think there's just going to be more good things to come. And like I said, I've just really enjoyed him.
Excellent. Now, I remember you were at Tokyo Dome, I don't know, a few years back, and it was either WBC or Premier 12 or some event, and Japan played really well. And actually, we were able to hear your broadcast that day. But what's your impression of the MPB players or Japanese players having covered some of this international baseball?
Yeah, I think what you've seen is you start to get – I think initially there was a perception that pitchers probably would have a better chance of coming over and succeeding because Nomo came over and succeeded. And there was suspicion in terms of offensive players, but then Ichiro and Matsui came over. You know, now, I mean, Otani's one of the best hitters in the sport over here, just period. And here's the other thing to consider, whatever you want to say, but if you look at the matchup, the numbers, Say it was a better hitter than Shohei in Japan. He was. Yeah. He was a better hitter. He had put up better numbers. Like in terms of on base and slugging, and those are the two stats that are most important to correlate with run scoring. He was a better hitter.
The second thing you said, I think, was he put up better numbers because the leagues are quite different. And Shohei was in a league that included a lot more harder throwers. And it was a superior league as well. So I think what you said, the second part, he did put up better numbers. I'm not sure that he was a better hitter, but he certainly had the production. But yes.
Yeah. So, I think that now you have a pretty good idea that there are plenty of players over there. I mean, I was impressed with a number of players when I did. It was 2009 was the WBC when I was over there, and I was impressed with not only the Japanese players but the Korean players as well. I mean, heck, we saw it. I mean, for a nice little stretch, Jung Ho Gung was a really nice player over here. So I don't think there's any question that there are more than enough guys capable of playing in Major League Baseball.
Now, we had Yu Darvish, we had Kosuke Fukudome, we had Kyuji Fujikawa. Those guys were past MPB stars who played for the Cubs. How much did you have to get caught up on the history of Japanese players with the Cubs?
Well, it's funny because I remember Fujikawa from the WBC, and then it's more – I mean, I saw all those guys while – I mean, I've been a broadcaster in the majors since 1997, so I saw all of them with the Cubs. So I remember when they signed Fukudome, who was, 4 years older than, the age at which they've signed Seiya Suzuki, and, Darvish is well-established as a pitcher over here in the major league. So, again, the Cub fan base is so rabid that I don't think they particularly care that he's from Japan or where he's from. They just want him to hit. And if he hits, they will love him. And if he doesn't hit, they won't.
I'm with you there. I'm a fan of sports as well, so I know how it works. Now, how happy are you that Say's got a name that isn't complicated?
You know, I got to say, I feel like with – I mean, I'm out of practice, but, when the WBC, I felt as though I started to get an idea of how names are pronounced and that type of thing. I mean, I had to do the WBC championship between Korea and Japan on the radio.
Yeah. I know.
It's okay. I don't mind that part of it. I think the one issue that I always beef with, and we still are in that middle space over here, but we still struggle in America to gringify these names, even the Latin players, where these guys, Alex Avila played and had a really good career in the major leagues. His father's name's Avila. But at a certain point, like, white Americans just couldn't get it. And so he just capitulated and said, okay, fine, it's Avila. And the same way, Tony Perez, like, that's not his name. His name isn't Tony. It's Tani. It's Atanasio. And it's not Perez. It's Perez. And so, the one thing I wish with all the guys that come over here is I wish they would say their name and make us say their name the way they want to say the way they want us to say their name. Because I'm certainly not down to have somebody call me Boog Scamby. You know what I mean? So, like, I think we owe it to try and pronounce the names the way they want their names to be pronounced.
I fully agree. Thank you. All right. So you're so lucky. We are both John. Actually, we've been doing the show for about 12 seasons now. We're in our 12th season here. I don't remember the last time we had someone named John as well on the show. So it was a pleasure to talk to you. And you're so lucky you have a nickname. I've got no nickname. My parents, I wish they would have worked a little bit harder on my name. At least they did not name me Jonathan. So that's the difference between you and me.
But I am a Jonathan. But, like, we could drop a Gibby on you, can't we?
It has never stuck. Gone from Gib to Gibby. And those guys were all, we had Gibby was Bob Gibson. And sure. I don't remember if they did call Kirk Gibson Gib a little bit, but I think he was a Gibby too. And that was already taken. And so nothing ever has ever stuck. So,
well, I mean, I stole my nickname, my Boog Powell. And I actually went up to him the first time I met him and introduced myself by, stammering and stumbling and explaining that I stole his nickname. And he cut me off and he said, oh, I know you are. He's like, yeah, it's cool. Boog, sure. So,
well, yeah, stolen or otherwise, nothing has ever stuck. So it was a pleasure to talk to you on the show this week, and we'll be watching. We always get the games. We get the games on a daily basis, although Ohtani kind of outshines him at times.
Sure.
But we get some of the games. So always just know that we're watching here from Japan as well.
Thanks, Gibby.
All right. So, I did realize after I talked to John that I had left out Mune Nori Kawasaki off of that list of former MPB guys who played with the Cubs. But it's always intimidating when I interview these professional speakers. And I know you and I are just old newspaper guys. We're not trained in this kind of stuff. And these guys are pros. So he has such a silky, smooth and polished voice. And I just felt like an idiot talking to him. But I did like what he had to say. What did you like?
Well, I'd say I'd focus on the old part there because you forgot Tsuyoshi Wada as well.
Oh, that's right. See, they're going to come out of the woodworks. But yes, thank you.
Okay. So, no, I absolutely thank you, John. Thanks for being on this.
John Chambi.
That's correct. Not the other one.
Not you. The other one. Oh, that was my nickname growing up because I was the middle child.
Okay.
So everybody knew the firstborn and they knew the baby who was a girl, but I was the other one. Oh, don't ever say that. Oh, tragic themes.
Okay. I could call you H.
Oh no, that's, I got nothing. No nicknames. Like I said, nothing stuck. H. You could call me H, but it has never stuck. So yes, go ahead.
Well, I had to reach out for someone. I had to ask for a friend. You know, what you used to call John.
I had to ask for a friend.
So anyway, H. I loved the stories, especially the one in the weight room with with David Ross. Yeah. Oh. And chocolate. Yeah, that was good. That jibes perfectly with my impression of Seiya Suzuki from Japan. He's one of these guys. He reminds me, although he came out of high school, he's not like your typical high school, you know, turn pro at a high school baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
And that he just carries himself. It's like he's a little more self-educated and self-aware than normal. He reminds me a little bit of Jesse Biddle in that respect with the Oryx Buffaloes, and that when you're talking to him, you get a sense that he's quite on the ball and quite sharp. Like he knows more things than just baseball.
Right.
He's bigger than baseball, and that's the impression I get with him. I get that also with other guys, but typically guys who've been to college like Yuki Inagita, who has, you know, he's kind of a goofball, and he's got goofball and fun stuff, but he's also really inside, he's also very serious and thoughtful. And I get the same vibe from Seiya Suzuki. So when I heard the stories, I think that is absolutely him.
Right now, on brand, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, right on brand is the word. And okay, two more things. And one is a great comment. I thought that was a great dialogue between you and the other John, and Boog about the Seiya's stats in Japan. And I would also add that when, you know, I talk about these kind of things too, and I say, for example, Shohei Ohtani and was very much, he tracked Hideki Matsui very closely when they were the same age.
Right.
But
yeah.
Okay. And Seiya Suzuki did not track Shohei Ohtani when they were the same age. The carp were still trying to figure out at what point they were going to give up on him as a shortstop or third baseman.
Mm-hmm.
Because he kept air mailing throws into the first base, you know, into the first base seats in the minor leagues.
Right.
So he had to go through that sort of process, and he was a couple of years behind him as a pro hitter. I don't know if that was a talent thing or opportunity issue, because Shohei certainly had the opportunities, but I would say he made a huge charge in the 24, 25, 26 year old period, as Boog said. So I thought that was good. And the other thing, the last thing I want to say is I'm so proud to listen to you guys talk about people's names, like these things that identify individuals should be important to us.
Yes.
And I think absolutely 100%. There's a long history. As you know, African-American players in the majors typically were called by their diminutives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't William, it was Willie. Every William became Willie, you know, Wilbur became Willie, William became Willie, Henry became Hank, you name it. And there was a step down in respect on the language side, and he was spot on. We don't need to continue that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the entire talk, and just like you talked about with the numbers, I like, that's why I said a lot of these things get lost in translation. It's mm-hmm. not just the language thing. It's how you interpret the numbers, and that if you just see the numbers on paper, yeah, oh, well, this guy's a better hitter because the numbers are better. And there's context with a lot of the things that go on in MPB, and people need to know that. And I don't think that gets transferred over or it makes the trip across the ocean. Sometimes it's just the number. So it was good to get that context. But yeah, I think it is noble of John to talk about the fact that people should pronounce the names that the way the players want them to be pronounced. But you and I know, having lived in a foreign country for so long, that it's not just about how someone goes about pronouncing a name, because that person who's receiving that message has to receive the message as it is intended. So I just remember talking to my father when I came to Japan, this is 30 years ago, and I went home and I said, yeah, I know this girl named Kyoko. And I said, Dad, we say in America, we say Tokyo, but it's only two syllables. It's Tokyo. And he couldn't process it audibly. He could not hear the difference. And when I said Kyoko and Kyoko, he said, yes, that's what I said. Why are you saying the same thing? So I realized you can have an intent. And look, in the States, where from state to state sometimes, but a lot of times with region to region, we pronounce the same word differently. So how can we expect an entire nation of mixed nationalities to pronounce names the same way? It's not going to happen. But we can set the standard, we can ask, and we can, that's all we can do, you know?
Sure. We can assume, I mean, the first assumption is we don't know. I mean, that's always the secure one.
Right.
You know, and you're right. If you're in the South, you know, you write with a pin.
Or if you're in the Midwest, the thing on your top of your house is a roof, not a roof. So, I mean, it's just different. And so that's just part of it. And also, like I said, people, you know, some people cannot process those sounds. So we can't expect them to be able to enunciate them as well. But it's very noble. And John working in as a broadcaster does as good a job, I think, as you can expect with the different nationalities that he has to contend with. So I mean, nobody is perfect. Let's just put it that way. And I always feel like I pronounce the Japanese names really well, but I'm sure if I heard my Japanese on a podcast in Japanese, and I would think, oh, that's awful. You know, how can I say it like that? So, you know, there's a rhythm and there's a rhyme to everything. And we fit it into our English language and the flow that goes there. So it's really difficult. So
it's not easy. I mean,
I know that.
I had this conversation with Rex Hudler a couple of times, once when he was the broadcaster for the Angels and once years later when he was the broadcaster for the Royals. And they had Norichika Oki. And he says,
oh gosh, yeah, his poor name, yeah.
Yeah,
the simplest name of one of the Japanese guys other than Suzuki. Although they do, a lot of people put that accent in there, Suzuki, a lot of times. So it's, but you know, Tanaka as well. But Aoki, right, you think people would be.
But Aoki, you would think so. And he says, yo, and he said, he told me straight up front, I go to great lengths to do it right. And then here he is saying Aoki.
Aoki, like, or Ioki. I mean, I don't know how they twist it around like that, but they do.
they probably saw him tracking a ball in left field and says, well, I guess it doesn't matter one way or the other. It's going to stick.
Oh, wow. So also, I like, I guess, the assumption, and rightly so, that we're just kind of protective of our MPB guys when they go over it, and we kind of stump for them. And I think John was just assuming that I was worried that when he started to talk about Suzuki, that maybe he's not a cornerstone player. He was so careful. Now, maybe John was talking to the audience, maybe not specifically to me, but remember when Suzuki went over that, I wasn't sure that he was going to be as good as he has been at the start. Now, of course, recently, of course, we do the interview and he starts slumping and doesn't get in the lineup a few times, but that's just part of the adjustment. I'm sure there are going to be some ups and downs, so that's just natural. But John was seemingly, he didn't want to offend me. And I'm like, no, and I didn't want to tell him and stop the flow that, hey, man, I didn't think he was going to be this good right away. I thought there was going to be more of an adjustment period. But
the vibe I get from David Ross is, from people I know who know David Ross, is that he's one of these guys who's very level-headed, like Joe Maddon's level-headed, and he knows that if you hype somebody, it's the other side of the coin from ripping people, because you're basically saying, you're setting up expectations that can't be met or are unlikely to be met.
Or sustained.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the whole thing. So I think that's what I caught. I don't want to say this guy's going to be the next evolution in baseball history. You know, he was really careful not to go there. I'm saying I just think he's going to be a really good ball player, and that's what I heard.
Yeah. So, okay. All right.
So I thought that was very gracious and eloquent of him.
Yeah, and the reason again I wanted to do this story or do this interview was we talked to Gary Hill Jr., the Seattle Mariners radio guy, in the offseason, and he talked about mining for stories and trying to get more information on these players, and it brought me back to the time when I was trying to get Nomo information when Nomo went to the Dodgers, and I called my friend who worked with the LA Daily News, and he said, "Man, you know, you can speak Japanese, Gib. We need you over here to help us out." The translator—I mean, Nomo speaks for like 2 or 3 minutes, and the translator comes back and says yes or no, and then that's it. And I'm like, "What?" You know, and I said, "You know, Nomo has this thick lisp; it's really thick." And he said, "I never realized that." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, it's sometimes not difficult to understand, but his Japanese doesn't sound right sometimes. It sounds like he's a foreigner sometimes because he's got such a thick lisp. But the media availability and all those things, a lot of times early on they talked about the translator. Now John Shambi, who doesn't know, says that the interpreter is really good, and I think he's okay. He leaves out a lot of stuff, but you know, there are guys who take notes when they do the simultaneous interpretation, or not simultaneous, but in turn interpretation, and there are guys who don't. And if you don't take notes, you're going to leave something out. So I don't think Matsushita takes notes that much. I think he's more of a remember.
Okay, so in the case of Ipe Mizuhara with Shohei Ohtani's interpreter with the Angels, he doesn't take notes, but these guys are so tight and they've known each other for so long that I often feel like Ipe knows what Shohei wants to say when Shohei can't say it.
They're sharing a brain.
They may well.
A baseball brain.
Unfortunate as that might be for Ipe's family.
Hashtag
hi. His lovely wife. It may be true, because I hear him say that, and I hear Shohei sort of, he sometimes grasps for words. He's a really good communicator because he's persistent as all heck when he wants you to know. But he'll be stumbling for the word he wants, or he just doesn't come quite out. And Ipe will sort of say it and cut to the chase.
Right.
But you're right. Sometimes Ipe will have, you know, the interpreter will have, this is what he's going to say, and he doesn't say it. and there's a little bit of, sometimes those guys who are really tight sometimes are on the off ramp when the other guy's in the fast lane.
Whoa. Over here, dude. So yeah, it's fun. And like I said, like, the guys who know, we can understand what Matsushita is saying. So we know he's leaving some things out, but people who don't know say, hey, it's terrific. So I'm like, okay, you know, you guys go with that. He's good. You know, I'm not saying he's not good, but
I don't think I've hardly heard him. So I can't say.
You're probably out of the room during the commercials. So that's a lot of times they play the interviews.
Right. See, most of Seiya's stuff, I just see it in print in Japanese. So
Gotcha. All right. Well, Boog, thank you so much. Can't thank you enough. It was a real pleasure to speak with you, and hope we can talk again sometime. Let's move along. A four-seam transition, and we're going to talk about the start of interleague play. Now, interleague play starts on Tuesday, and we know the Pacific League has dominated for what seems like, I don't know, a couple centuries now. But last year, you know, we know interleague play started in 2005, so I'm joking. But last year, Oryx had the best record in interleague play. They were 12-5-1. They're only 18 games, and they edged out the Hanshin Tigers, who were 11-7. But a lot of Central League teams were up in the top five, so that was really nice. And the Central League, for the first time in a long time, had more victories head-to-head. They went 49-48-11. And this is after the COVID situation washed out interleague play in 2020. You got something?
Yeah. Yeah. So last year, right. So the Central League did manage to have the best record.
Yes.
They did so despite being fairly well outscored by the Pacific League. So it was kind of a, well, no, it doesn't matter, but it's one of those things where you said if they played more games, it probably wouldn't have turned out like that.
Well, good.
Because the season...
They didn't play more games.
No, it's not. No, the season is what we call a small... A baseball season is a small sample size, is what I'm telling you. Right. So, okay, so, but that's all right. That's all right. So two times in since 2005, and Johnny Kuroki, Tomohiro Kuroki, the former ace of the Lotte Marines, came out today and said, Central League's gonna do really, really well in Interleague this year. And if you want to read my thoughts on that, go to my blog. I've got some charts and tables in there. I'll give him credit. He said, this is where I don't have any basis for my judgment, and this is where I do. And I didn't attack the part where he said he was just guessing.
I didn't attack. You got off light, chump.
I saved it for the other side.
Right.
So,
right.
And so we discuss on the blog, I discuss his the difference in fastballs between the two leagues and the different ways they pitch a little bit, just going into some numbers stuff. But I'm doubtful. I don't think the Central League has caught up. I understand where he's going with that. I mean, I see Shigomaki and I see Munetaka Murakami and I see Kazuma Okamoto, and I think, wow, there's some real hitters here. And there are. But again, as you pointed out with Boogs Shambi, that context matters. The pitching is different. The situation is different. The styles are different. Lots of things are different. So
I'm not
taking it at face value, because it just hasn't the differences are fairly apparent when they start playing each other.
Okay. So before last year, the only other time the Central League had a better head-to-head record in Interleague was 2009. They went 70-67-7. And look, the worst teams in Interleague play historically have been the DeNA BayStars and the Hiroshima Carp. Each team has finished last five times. The Carp have a winning percentage of .426. Just 152 wins. The Bay Stars have the fewest wins overall, 148, and a winning percentage of .410. But on the other hand, the best, the SoftBank Hawks, have finished seven times an NPB high in first place in interleague play, .619 winning percentage. And then next is Lotte with a .538 winning percentage. So a lot of numbers there, but basically, Jim's probably right. But, you know, I started watching NPB baseball with a Central League team. I'm always going to root for the Central League teams, and I hope they do well. And it was nice to see them get their little one-win victory last year. But I'm with you, Jim. I don't have high hopes. I don't feel like Kuroki that... There's something about these Central League teams, because the Central League teams include the Hanshin Tigers, who just seem to not be able to do much right, the Chunichi Dragons, who definitely are not doing a lot of things right, and the Carp, who sometimes do things right. So that doesn't bode well for trying to win. You know, you got three teams in your league that are pulling you back, and I don't think the other teams can win every night, so... I don't think they have a really good chance of doing anything. And here's the other thing. We're looking at the last place team in the Pacific League. I think that's the Fighters. And the way Tsuyoshi Shinjo, Big Boss, manages games, you never know what he might do, when he might do it, or why. So I think he could throw a lot of these CL skippers way off their usual game, whatever that is, because they won't see any of this coming. So no matter what they've seen in the highlights or on video or whatever they're using to do their research on these PL teams, I don't think they're ready for what he might do. And I would imagine that the Fighters are going to have a really good record in interleague play. Just guessing.
Okay, I just wanted to come out with the. I know you were interested. I don't know if you. This was a sort of a different look at Interleague, but I was looking at which teams have been the best relative to how well they. You know, which teams are either seriously worse in Interleague than they are in the league.
Oh, right. Didn't you talked about this last season as well? Yeah,
I did. Yeah. Well, this really won't change because I didn't add the numbers from 2021 yet. But yeah, you're right on. It's like the SoftBank Hawks are a 560 team since 2005. From 2005 to 2019, the SoftBank Hawks were a 560 team against the Pacific League and a 629 team against the Central League.
Come over and have some whips, some whippings. We give out right. Free whippings. Free cans of whip.
Yeah, there was a lot of whip. In fact, the only Central League team that made the best six, the only Central League team that was remotely close.
Los Gigantes.
No.
It wasn't the Giants.
It was not. The Yakult Swallows have a 468 winning percentage in the league since 2015 and a 465 winning percentage in Interleague. Virtually the same. And
go Swallows.
Go Swallows. I think the reason for that was largely because of Jingu Stadium. Because the Pacific League pitchers, as you know, used to come, you know, most of the PL parks were huge until the last 4 or 5 years when they started bringing the fences in. So Sendai was huge. Sapporo Dome still is, but Sendai was huge. Fukuoka Dome was huge. Lotte was huge. And then they started bringing the fences in. Anyway, so the Pacific League pitchers would go to Jingu and say, what's up with this home run stuff? You know, what's up with that fly ball? That shouldn't even be reaching the warning track at Sapporo Dome, and it's 10 rows back. So,
right. Or you just have a lot of concern about allowing a home run, and you start pitching differently and getting off your games. So, yeah.
I think, but that kind of popped up in the data in a number of places. So yeah, that was the thing. And you're right. The other end of the table are the Carp, who are a 504 winning percentage team against the Central League and a 436 winning percentage team against the Pacific League. Like, ooh. Yeah, ouch. Ouch. So, okay.
And give me your lunch money too. Yeah.
That's right. Now, take off them sneakers. We want them.
Yeah. You don't need that per diem.
Okay.
All right, making a two-seam transition, it's time for Rockin' with Roki, the Rayra rock star. So Friday night at Fukuoka PayPay Dome, he worked 7 innings, allowed a run, had 9 strikeouts, 4 hits, a couple walks, hit a batter, and improved to 5-0. And that was an 8-1 win for the Marines. So it was supposed to be a showdown against SoftBank ace Kodai Senga, but the Hawks ace really pitched more like a joker, and he was gone along with his catcher, Takuya Tai, after like 4 innings. Now, you said that the manager kind of blew up and was disgusted at them. I remember you either said it on a blog post.
In a blog post, right. He had some harsh words saying, like, your fastball didn't get like bad all of a sudden. How come you two stopped throwing it? So after the 4th inning, after Senga had thrown about 57 pitches, he said, I've seen enough of you off of my mound, and you back in the bench. Watch this game from the bench. He said to Takuya Kai, Japan's
watch and learn. Yeah,
that's right. Watch this kid from the minor leagues catch in your place.
Yeah, that was weird.
So he was very unhappy. But then the next day, Kodai Senga was deactivated with tightness in his elbow. So I think those two things may have gone together.
Or, you know, maybe he came out with it after he got taken out of the game. They said, well, look, either you're messing up or you're messed up. So which one is it? And so he said, well, my arm's messed up. So let's get it taken care of. So how long it stays off.
Yeah. Well, apparently it's just going to be the minimum 10 days. And Fujimoto was saying on Friday night that when he had his little blow up, he said that I expected to see more. Didn't we talk about seeing more fastballs than last time? And we've got less.
But no, not going to work here.
No. So anyway, no. And Sasaki, for his, when he pitched at, he's pitched most of his games at home. And at home, things are really good for him. He knows the situation. His velocity he had his best velocity ever on the road at Fukuoka Dome.
This past Friday.
Yes. But his command of his fork ball was pretty lame. He was missing a lot. I mean, it was like all over the place. You know, on TV, they show, oh, here's a strikeout with that fork ball, but they didn't show the ones where his catcher had the glove near the ground and he had to stand up to catch it.
Yeah, it just seemed like it was more of a knuckleball than a forkball that day, because he had no idea where it was going, and neither did the hitter. So it helped him in some instances, and it hurt him in others. And then I got the impression that some of the hitters were saying, well, he's not throwing it where he wants to. I'm sitting on a fastball, and when I get one, I'm going to get a hit.
But, well, that was the Eurispo Gracial approach. Because he basically forced him to throw fastballs in the zone, and he smoked them.
Well, again, you got a different class of hitter sometimes. There's still some young Hawks hitters out there who they're good hitters, but when it comes to approach, they can see ball, hit ball, but when it comes to approach, maybe they're not as polished as a guy like Gracial.
I've seen it with the Buffaloes, where it's like their adjustment has been to either look forkball or fastball and wait for him to make a mistake and then, go after that one pitch. Because, and I think some of the Hawks guys were, I think most of the Hawks guys were looking fastball because he started, Ko Matsukawa said, just held the glove in the middle of the zone for a forkball. Right. The guys were looking at it saying, that's not a fastball. Yeah. But it's a strike. Damn.
Yeah. Take that. So yeah. But I just noticed one thing. Remember, I actually did look up that article that I helped rewrite last week and then tweeted out sometime after I did the podcast tweet. And in the article, it discussed the foresight the team has for sacrificing short-term rewards for long-term goals and how the Marines are really thinking and executing this plan. Well, part of that was no max effort pitching. And basically I've been calling since last season, I'm like, let him cut it loose, let my people go. I think it actually, he looked like a couple of times on Friday that he did actually let it go and cut loose. And I'm not saying it was a max effort, but the 164 on the gun, I think he hit it multiple times. And
Four times.
Okay. I didn't see every pitch, so I couldn't say. But I'll bet you he has the freedom now, based on what I saw on Friday, to dial it up a couple, three times a game when he wants to in certain situations and needs a big pitch or a strike or an out. I think he has been given permission to do that. And just for a few pitches a game, not every pitch, obviously. Right. But
Well, he did turn 20 in November, so I don't think he needs a note from his mom anymore.
Oh, well. I might. I'm still young. Remember, my kids are young, so I'm still young.
That's right. You project off of them. What's the opposite of projection? Like, my kids are young, so am I. We'll see how long that works.
Yeah. I don't like your attitude, sir.
Okay.
All right. A couple of notes. We did see Akira Neo of the Dragons be, and I joked, I said on Twitter, he's a no way player, but he made his two way debut this weekend on Saturday. He pitched an inning, put up a scoreless inning, but it was in a blowout situation. So I guess he's a mop up pitcher, which is, not a bad way to go. But then he came up and bat in the next inning. I think I tweeted that he led off the inning, but he's actually second in the inning and made an out. So congratulations to him. I want to see if they continue to use him as a pitcher. He did hit 150 on the gun, which was kind of impressive. But and then we had Naoki Miyanishi of the Fighters, who became the eighth pitcher to make at least 800 appearances. He did that on Saturday. He's the all-time leader in hold points, if you guys know what those are. So number is 413 in its hold points. He's a 15-year veteran. He is 36. He turns 37 in about 10 days. And I could see a crafty lefty like him pitching until he's 40. So I think, let's see, I didn't do the math at all, but he has these 800 appearances. I think he could get, he could challenge Hitoki Iwase's all-time mark of 1,022 games, you know, played in or pitched in or appearances.
I think it's possible.
But he, I don't know. He's kind of, he's getting fewer games now, and we just haven't seen a lot of him. And the injuries, he hasn't had a major injury, but I think he has. He gets, like I do, these knick-knack injuries that just knock him out for a couple weeks or a couple whatever, and he's gone. So you have to keep an eye on it. But I think he's got a chance to challenge. But I'm the one. I don't like compiler guys, and I know he has been really good over the years, but now I think he's just one of those guys out in the bullpen. You don't really want to throw him as much as you want to throw younger guys who throw harder. And so I'm not sure that, you know, I don't know what, obviously we have no idea what the big boss's plans are for him, but we haven't seen much of him this season. So I'm thinking his appearances are going to taper off as long as big boss is the manager.
Yep, I think you just kind of have to roll with Shinjo being Shinjo.
All right, let's roll with fielding questions. All right, so we've had this question a couple, three episodes maybe. But that's what happens sometimes. It's from Corgi Racing, and I don't know where he's located. I don't remember if it's a he or a she, but it came via the Reddit feed. And he said, great listen to this week's episode. And I can't tell you what episode that was, but it was a while back. He said, your podcast is my traditional Monday morning workout listen. So I know we've been talking about how poorly Han Sheen has started. And I agree with Jim that the puff up to eventual scapegoat conveyor belt at Han Sheen doesn't help them. However, Teruaki Sato has had a similar beginning to the season. He actually... Corgi Racing gave us the stats, but they're much better now. He has 10 home runs. He's got 24 RBIs, 14 walks. So to update the numbers that Corgi Racing gave us. Now, more importantly, in light of Sato's second half struggles last season, he's doing it with a decent batting average and OPB. So could we be seeing another Jekyll Hyde first half like last season, or perhaps he's making the necessary adjustments? I'm no Tigers fan, but Sato's start should be a silver lining for that team. Jim, your feelings?
I like where he's going. I mean, nobody knows what adjustments he has. I mean, last year he had, you know, we talked, or you and Boog talked about the adjustments, you know, Japanese players have to make going to America. And players coming out of college ball and industrial league ball, they've got to make adjustments too. The schedule's completely different. The intensity is very different. The feel is different. And, you know, that can be even for somebody as strong. I mean, the guy's built like a horse. It's not easy. And I think, you said, let's see how he does in the second half last year. But of course, mechanically, he kind of broke down, and it wasn't just physically; it was more of a mechanical. His approach kind of broke down.
All right. Well, I was going to say, because maybe sometimes the mechanical breakdown is because of a physical thing, but you said it was a bit more.
I think it was more of things started going badly, and then he started grasping for the wrong solutions. Okay. Or at least that's what people who know vastly more about hitting tell me.
Okay.
Thank you, Kenichi. And so I think that was the thing. I suspect he's gotten more input, and you know, he's got fewer surprises this year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect to see that kind of big slump. I think he'll have little slumps like everybody has, but I think I like pretty much everything I've seen from him this year. I don't expect any sort of thing dragging him down. I think like the Tigers, he's going to get better in the second half.
All right. Well, for me, I just see before you marry that Jekyll Hyde label, that things to keep in mind include the fact that the league had to do its homework on Sato, I think, and it took that first half. And then the player himself, like Jim said, had never gone through this much baseball. At least that's what my interpretation of your statement was, that, you know, that's the schedule is different. There's a lot more baseball. There's a lot more practicing. It's your job. These guys take it so seriously. There's a lot more studying involved. So the mental side is challenging. The physical side is challenging. And then you've got to go through the actual games. You know, that's not, you practice, you do all the study, and then you play the games, and then you have to talk to the media all the time. It's really time consuming. And this, just the rigors of a full slate of games, even going for a week, it was completely different from anything he had done before. So it's just no surprise that you say approach, maybe the mental side was fatigued as well. That brain muscle had worn down, but he, you know, he's making adjustments at coming into the second year. He looks, you know, he looks good. He looks a lot more imbalanced. Most of the time when I'm watching him, you still have the human element behind the plate, not the catcher, making mistakes or making calls that you don't agree with. So he has all those things to fight. But I just think that second half of last season, I think there were a lot of factors. If he can obviously stay steady, which is the biggest test for young players, is to be at least somewhat consistent, have the power stroke that he has had, have the average at a spot where what the media isn't calling for your head, because it's not good enough. You know, the media wants it all, right? You have to hit for average, you have to hit for power, and you have to hit in the clutch. You know, one of those things is missing. The media gets on you. Well, yeah, he's doing well, but you know, he doesn't hit in the clutch, or he's doing well, but we don't see any home runs, or he's doing well, but his average is bad. So it's just never enough. And I think the same can be said for a lot of the fans as well. So, you know, if he hits 250 and he approaches, you know, 25 home runs, 30 home runs, and he has 80 plus RBIs, I think that's a well-spent season for him as a player and his growth. And, you know, the results are going to be what they are. He plays on a team. He can't catch every ball. He can't knock in every run. It's just not going to work that way. So I don't know about Jekyll and Hyde. I just think last year, the first half was, there was a learning curve on both sides for him and for the opponents. And I think they caught up to him, and he came back to the pack, and then he also had fatigue. So I don't expect there to be any fatigue for this season. Now he's getting used to it. You said he's built like a horse. I say he juggles horses as a side hobby, because that guy is strong. Remember I said I saw him with no shirt and the muscles popping out of the muscles. So, yeah, he's going to have no trouble with that aspect. I just think he had to get used to it, and I think that marathon aspect is going to be fine this year. So I've got my eyes firmly fixed on the Sato, the Teruaki Sato, who's going to have that second half of a season that we probably expected last year when he didn't get the Rookie of the Year award. I think he'll be fine. I think we also should keep an eye on the Giants pitchers, because we talked about how many, what was it, six in April who got their first wins. And I think when we get to August and September, if any of them gets a win, it'll be be a feather in their cap, because they're going to be tired too. Yeah, I want to hit on a high heat comment, and that came from our own Michael Westbay, who's in Kanagawa, and it came via message. And he said, "I loved the conversation with Carlos last week, especially the rant. I'd love to see him become a major league manager and put some of this philosophy to the test." So as I was talking with Jim before we actually started recording, it's, you know, I know Michael, he's such a nice guy. I don't think this comes across, and I tried to read it in a kind of upbeat way, because I don't think he was being snarky, although I know Michael likes analytics and prefers to look at the game that way. But I don't think that this is that kind of snarky comment. I just think it's, hey, you know, if you think it's going to work, let's see it work. Now, Michael, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my comment, this comment tells me two things. And one, that you don't think that he'd be successful. And then two, that maybe you're not taking into account the context. And I'm always thinking, okay, who's right? Who's wrong? Is it all the numbers guys who, you know, have the books and the calculators and analytics guys, or is it all these old scouts who sit around and say, well, you know, they've got a stogie in their mouths and they're spitting on the side of the road there and saying, well, let me see. And, you know, I've got to see. And I think there's a beautiful, perfect mix out there of analytics and eye tests. But as we were talking about before, as Jim and I were saying before we started recording, nobody knows exactly what a player is going to project to. Nobody knows exactly what like I said last year or 2 years ago, I said these the way a lot of people use the term sample size, it's nebulous. It has no meaning because nobody ever assigns a number to it. We need X number of at bats before we know. And even if you think you know, you don't know. So, what's your take on this comment?
Well, I think you're right. I think you do have to be precise, and you know, like, what's a small sample size is different depending on, you know, what we're talking about. It depends on how much noise there is in the data. You know, I said earlier that a season is a small sample size. It's a really small sample size for, you know, determining how good a baseball team is. Just because we know that from research, you know, that's one of the things we do know, is that it's a small, you know, that weak teams can have the best record fairly easily in something like a 162 game season. And so people say, well, what's the point, of course? And the point is to win the championship. That's it. That's, you know, you do the analytics not to have the best team, but to essentially to give you the best chance of winning the championship. So, the problem is that knowledge is so, the amount of knowledge in the world is infinitesimal.
Mm.
We know so little of what actually is, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. Knowledge, things that we can absolutely rest our hats on. So much else is just best guesses.
Right.
And the problem, of course, is when you take, oh, we know this and we know that, so let's extrapolate it to this other thing. And then you get things like, you get unintended consequences. And that happens all the time. You know, you get that with scouts who say, you know, well, I know this player A and this player B, and this guy looks like player A, so I expect him to fit the following pattern. But they know also human beings are different. People right. who know numbers also know human beings are different. But we all are trying to make people fit patterns we understand and project the way we see them, whether it's with numbers or with an eye test. But yeah, the whole thing is a total lack of real, real hard knowledge. And analytics isn't knowledge. It's more information than we had before. And sometimes it does lead to real knowledge. And sometimes it's just more, you know, it's just, again, another best guess.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, when people say, well, this manager made the wrong move because he sent so-and-so up. And I'm like, well, you know, if you're basing that on the result, then... Yeah, sure. Whenever yep. someone fails, that's you can always say that. But what you really want to say is, well, this person gave them a better chance
yep.
on paper. But then again, the manager is the one who knows. And I always say this, who has the nicked knee or who fouled a ball off of that toe or whose shoulder is sore. And we right. don't. So no. you don't know. You know,
no,
you don't know. All you can do is add the information with the numbers, but you don't know.
No, and in fact, nobody knows. And you have to always, you know, you have to do like Johnny Kuroki does and draw a line. At some point, you have to say, this is the limit of my knowledge, but within that limit of my knowledge, this is how I see it.
And that's, I got a feeling.
That's, I mean, thanks, John Lennon. What I'm saying is, if you understand the limits, is probably the best thing to do. Know where the hard knowledge ends. And this saying, this is my guess. Basically, we're making guesses based on what we do actually know. And that's not like saying we do know.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I said on the show a couple, 3 years back is that someone said, you know, this guy has a lot of spin on his pitches. I'm like, well, that doesn't make him, I don't think it works in the reverse. You don't go to someone and say, you know what? You're not doing this. Let's get more spin on the pitches. I think the better pitchers tend to have better spin. And that just because you get better spin on a pitch doesn't mean you're going to be a better pitcher. You know, you're good. You can be better, but that's not, this is not going to make you a better pitcher per se.
And even that, it can be better defined, but I know what you're saying, but yep.
Okay. So interesting stuff. It's really hard on a cold screen, smartphone or computer to really interpret how that statement was meant, but I think it was made with good intentions because hopefully, you know, Carly, you said Carlos was coaching Indian team.
Well, he's working with the Indian Baseball Federation, or at least he was the last time we spoke.
I don't know about major leagues, but he can certainly still, if he's keeping those relationships going like he talked about, maybe he can end up over here and manage in Japan and we can watch. It'd be fun.
If Tsuyoshi Shinjo can manage, I mean, the sky's the limit.
All right. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Anyone else who has a question or comment, hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag High Heat. Send questions by email to yakyujohn@gmail.com. And you can hit us up on the Facebook page. Look for us on Google Play and iTunes. We will talk to you next week. Enjoy your baseball.
And see you at the ballparks.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. And feel free to submit your questions by email or tweet with hashtag High Heat. Thank you for listening to Japan Baseball Weekly.